Gurmil Magad Mora, tonight on Arena. Colm Tobin on Mary Lavin, photographer Jackie Nickerson on her new exhibition, and Dr. Miller plays live in studio. And as always, you can text us on 51551. Our WhatsApp is 087-032-3232. You can email us to arena@rte.ie, and we're on Instagram @rte_arena. Now, as a country, we have produced great writers, far more than an island of our size should ever dare to do. And one could argue that it's the world of the short story, those spare few pages of perfect prose, at which we've excelled at even more than our world-shifting novels. Everyone from William Trevor to Frank O'Connor to Claire Keegan has written the perfect short story. But today we are celebrating Mary Lavin, who wrote brilliant short stories from the 1950s and was regularly published in The New Yorker, the proceeds from which she was able to buy a muse in Dublin 4, where other writers such as John McGahern and Patrick Kavanagh would gather. So one of her most fervent champions is not a bad writer himself, Colm Tobin, who has selected his favourite stories of hers for a new collection. And Colm joins me on the line. Colm, you are very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And I heard you on with Brendan O'Connor over the weekend. Of course, you were talking about your own collection of short stories at the News from Dublin. But we're going to talk about Mary Lavin. You read her while you were still at school. What did you see in her writing that made you want to read more of her?
They were very memorable, the stories that were on, I think they were on the Intercert. There used to be a thing called the Intercert course, a story called The Widow's Son, which was a story that had two endings. And I was sort of literary, aged 14 and 15, so I went to the library in Wexford and I found other books by her and a few stories that have stayed with me really all the years, one called Happiness and the other called In the Middle of the Fields and the other called In a Café. And so when I was selecting this anthology of her work, these were the three sort of flagship stories, and I built the rest of the selection around those three stories.
In the Middle of the Fields is a really powerful short story, and she writes about being a widow in that as well. So did you identify, you know, with that in some way?
Yeah, my mother was a widow, so I was interested in, sorry, if I saw the word widow. Oh, widow, look. And when I came to Dublin in 1972, you could see Mary Lavin around certain parts of the city. She could be in Bewley's in Grafton Street. She could be in a place called the Country Shop, which was near Baggot Street. She could be walking along Stephen's Green. She could be in Stephen's Green. She had this muse house in Lad Lane off Baggot Street. But she was usually alone. She was usually dressed in black. She had her hair back in a, she didn't do a perm or the normal hairdo that Irish women of that generation did. She had her hair back in a bun. She looked slightly distracted. I mean, the National Library, she could look especially distracted, wandering, you know, looking for books, but there was nothing distracted about her. She was very sharp. And you realise that when you read the stories, just the sheer attention to detail. I went to interview her when her selected stories came out first from Penguin in 1981. So I'm sort of 25 years old, and she's a sort of senior writer, and she has a house on a bend in the River Boyne, which she'd inherited from her husband. And she had a way of starting the conversation and then saying, now what was I talking about? And then going back to that subject and circling around, as her stories often did, until she would swoop on a conclusion. But she told me something amazing, that she had a contract with The New Yorker. But they only paid her for the stories they used, but they paid her more above the odds. But she had to send them everything she wrote. And when she had a choice between, she would have three stories in her head. She could only write one just now. She would pick the one she thought they were least likely to use, meaning she would never write for the money or write, you know, for the market, that she had a sort of distance from that. But of course, she could be wrong. They could end up using them. And there's a marvelous new book about her relationship with her editors at The New Yorker. But in ways she wrote about her own life, mm-hmm. and in ways she dramatized it, found key moments, so that it was almost, some of it was almost fictionalized, some of it was almost very deeply connected mm-hmm. to how she lived and what preoccupied her.
You're talking about her attention to detail, and I just want to just come back to In the Middle of the Fields. And I was listening to you read her short story on the New Yorker podcast, and like you said, attention to detail. There was a bit where she talks about her husband's shoes that were in the hallway. And then you find out that her husband's name is Robert. And that to me, you know, that kind of, as you said, she swoops in and then you're like, oh, her husband's name is Robert. He wasn't mentioned thus far, you know, in the short story. And she was able to build tension. I don't know how you feel, you know, about that particular short story, but I was tense. I didn't know what was going to happen. And then what actually happened in the end wasn't what I anticipated.
Yes. It's like that thing I was talking about, that story in the middle of the fields, which is, I think, one of her masterpieces, that it seems to be circling around somewhere else. And then it swoops into it over another territory that she's talking about being a widow. And there are a number of things where she breaks the cliche. You know, she feels much safer in the middle of the fields than she would in a house on the edge of the road. That even though her husband is recently dead, people think she wants to talk about him. She wants people to raise the subject of him so she can sort of bring him back in her memory. But she doesn't want that. That's the last thing she needs, is to hear his name. And there are a lot of things like that in the story where you think one thing would be true and another thing is true. Mm-hmm. And then when a man comes to the door, it is too late at night. And there is an element of him intruding on her. And there is a slight element of danger, but then she swoops away from that. And then she moves into the story of his life, into the man's life. And so it is the story, a real story of an encounter, and you don't know which way it's going to go. And it's very dramatic, it's very powerful, and it seems extraordinarily real.
No, it really does. And I think that a lot of women, you know, who listen to that short story would be able to identify, you know, that fear and loss and loneliness of living in a house on your own. Well, there's three children, obviously, in that story as well, but they don't really feature, do they? They're in the background.
No, the children are upstairs in bed, so there's a whole sense of all that part of the evening is over. There's now nothing to be left except a few hours before sleep. Mm-hmm. And this disruption comes. And then you don't know which way it's going to go.
Mm-hmm. How difficult is it to write a short story? And why do you think the Irish are quite so good at them?
Well, Frank O'Connor wrote a book about it called The Lonely Voice. And I suppose he was talking about there was once an idea that there was not enough, let's say, middle class life in Dublin or in Cork. Or in Ireland, that in other words, to give a character enough chances and choices to allow a character to face her destiny, say in Jane Austen, just go back that far, you would need a house. You would need a garden around the house. You would need parkland around the garden, and you would need many, many thousands of acres around that. And in that case, you have a settled society. Everybody knows their place in it. People have 10,000 a year. Try and bring that over to Ireland. First of all, the house, the glass would be broken. Someone would be threatening to burn it. We know the garden would be weeds and the parkland didn't exist. And agricultural land was the most disputed, contested thing in the whole country, with the Land League and all the different evictions. So that you just couldn't get that notion of a settled world in, you know, even in Dublin. So that, you know, modernism came easy. You could write a big, untidy, massively ambitious novel such as Ulysses. But to try and write a novel about a middle-class family, such as John Galsworthy did with The Forsytes, for example, or Balzac did, or Thomas Mann did, Ireland didn't have enough, let's say, textured class life or the possibilities of people facing their destiny. So you could get a moment of pure disappointment really well in an Irish story. You could get an only child, you could get a spoiled priest, you could get a widow, you could get someone living a very isolated life, you could get the possibility of happiness and then that being thwarted. That these were the things that would almost lend themselves naturally to a place as isolated as Ireland. And indeed, you get some of the same tones in some Icelandic fiction or indeed in some Catalan fiction. The idea that adulthood is not something that, you know, it isn't as though it could be a family, and that that some of the family would emigrate, for example, in an Irish story, and there would be the loss and loneliness of them being away. So that the idea is that then the story would lend itself to having the same sort of effect as a song, mm-hmm. that a song could begin simply. Mm-hmm. It could look ordinary. Mm. And something would happen between the melody and the voice and the words that would lift the moment in a way that was mysterious, and that you wouldn't quite understand as you were reading. It would give you a sort of shiver, which I think is what happens in The Middle of the Fields. I think is what happens in a story like Happiness by Mary Lavin. I think it's what happens in her story In a Cafe, that there's a moment where you feel something has turned, something has shifted. And there was a theory once that this was something that the Irish experience lent itself to. I think this theory has been demolished somewhat by the arrival of John Banville, the arrival of Sally Rooney. You know, almost every novelist who writes now sets up themselves in opposition to that theory that in Ireland you can't write novels. But still, in the stories of Colin Barrett or Claire Keegan, as you said, you're still getting that idea of a single individual in a slightly remote, lonely place, feeling something or doing something or experiencing something that is mysterious, even to the reader.
Can you remember the first short story that you read and wasn't Mary Lavin, actually?
I mean, there's a William Trevor short story called Access to the Children. And it's about a man who gets to bring his kids out on an outing. He's divorced. And the agreement is he can bring them out once a fortnight. But he goes into brings them into a pub because it's raining. I think that's why he brings them into a pub. But he gets drunk slowly. You watch him getting slowly drunk and begins his grievance all about his wife and all the things she's done to him. And you realise he's drinking far too much and the kids are growing wild. And of course, he's going to bring them back incredibly late. And he has messed up the whole day. And whatever way it's done, because you're in his mind all the time, there's something absolutely brilliant about it. That's one of those stories where you're watching the dilemma of somebody else as though it becomes your dilemma, and you're living in his mind as though it's you. But the story, Mary Lavin's story, Happiness, which was the title of a book of stories, is really told by her daughter. It's told by the woman's daughter. And I was in university with Mary Lavin's daughter, Caroline Walsh, who later became literary editor of the Irish Times. And it's almost written in a way that's almost almost uncanny in Caroline's voice, which was close in a way to her mother's voice, of just telling a story about her mother, that her mother loved the idea of happiness. She talked a lot about happiness, what happiness was, what happiness meant. And it just reminds you of a lot of people in Ireland, you know, aunts you have or grandmothers who would have a theory about some area of life, happiness. Now, I think happiness is this or that. Mm-hmm. But then you realise that there are many other things going to happen in the story. Mm-hmm. That her experience as a widow, her experience of losing her husband, that was really what everything she's saying is disguising or concealing. That there is something much deeper and darker going on in her life. And that's given away slowly in the story. The narrator is in some way both unreliable and to be trusted. And you can't judge. But you realise that the initial paragraph about happiness, her mother's view on happiness, was set up to distract you. Mm. And that's the most fascinating idea, where there is another character in the story who's the reader. And the reader's being wrong-footed and then brought into the story and then brought out again. And that's a most fascinating idea. Mm,
absolutely. And, you know, we mentioned before the fact that she hosted many great writers and others, you know, literary leanings in her Muse House near the canal in Dublin. What do you imagine those gatherings were like? Like, were they like a prison salon or something more homely, I wonder?
Well, you see, there were two sorts of gatherings going on usually on those evenings. One was a gathering of writers in MacDade's, who were drinking as much as they could, and Flann O'Brien, you know, Patrick Kavanagh, Anthony Crone, and some of the younger poets. And that would be generally male. Well, it wouldn't be all male, but it would be mainly male. And there would be no food. There'd be no food involved. And there would be a lot of literary talk, but a lot of drunken literary talk. And everybody enjoyed it immensely. But the gatherings in Lad Lane were different in that they were, I suppose, there was spaghetti bolognese, which was an unusual thing at the time. There was red wine rather than whiskey or pints of Guinness. And I suppose the talk would have been more, let's say, sober and cosmopolitan. So it would be very different. It would be a sort of salon led by Mary Lavin rather than the wit and wisdom of a Flann O'Brien or Patrick Kavanagh. So they were really, really, the two of them could be held on the same evening. One or two people could go to both, but not many.
Right, well, I'd love to be a fly on either of those walls, do you know? And Colm, can I ask you, did she directly influence you in your writing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the idea that in the city you're living in, as a student, I was 17, 18 years old, there's this woman and you could see her and you could read her and you could see her new books were coming out. And that also, she was one of those writers who was always available to come to a university, you know, that she wouldn't charge a big fee or make any fuss or want expenses. You just didn't, I mean, I invited her to come to University College Dublin and I just got a letter back saying, of course. And and she came and she was brilliant. And I suppose that sense of what was possible. Most writers at that time, you know, that you were reading were almost, in, for example, John McGahan was never in Dublin. I never saw him. There was no reading by him. There was no event where he was speaking. So that, you know, you read his books, but he was living elsewhere. Mary Lavin was very different, and she was very friendly. But there's also the sense of her absolute devotion to her work, that the books appeared. She was what Henry James calls a constant producer. And what's really great about her now is that that a lot of people in New York, in publishing and in London, had forgotten about her. And when it was drawn to their attention, there was this writer, and there were all these stories by her, which were just brilliant. And she was more or less out of print. I mean, she was in print in Ireland, but not in print in other countries. And this is enormous. I mean, this book, An Arrow in Flight, the selected stories, it's everywhere you go in New York, and people are talking about it, and people are discovering her in America and in England. And the other day, I got an email from an editor in China to say, who owns the rights to those Mary Lavin stories? How could we get them in China? And so this is just so it's a big moment. It's a rediscovery of a very important writer.
And what do you think she'd make of it?
I think she had an idea of her own worth. I think she realized that by one of the things she didn't do was she didn't write about the War of Independence or the Civil War, or the sort of the whole background of rural violence in Ireland, that she stuck to what she knew or what she thought she could imagine well, which was a sort of middle-class Dublin and middle-class Meath. And she wrote about it with an interest not in farming systems or class systems, but the human heart, how people behave under pressure, what it's like to be alive. And I think she understood. Because, you see, she was terribly well-educated and well-read, meaning she'd read Chekhov, she'd read Turgenev, she had read Maupassant. She knew what would abide.
So there you go. Thank you, Cullum Tobin. And An Arrow in Flight by the great Mary Lavin, selected by Cullum Tobin, is published by Vintage Classics and features an introduction by Cullum as well.